Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly podcast reminder that libertarianism still exists. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Good morning, colleagues.
Howdy.
Hi, Matt.
In a moment, that's the enthusiasm we're looking for there,
yeah,
Peter.
Yeah, that was a very borderline depressed Happy Monday. Are you not happy about it being Monday?
It's a happy Monday, like all happy Mondays.
In a moment, we're going to talk about one of the most expensive pieces of legislation ever signed into law. But first, as the discerning listeners of the Reason Roundtable surely know, the thing we call health insurance does not, in fact, always pay for the full amount of medical bills during an emergency, especially for transportation. Even with comprehensive coverage, you can still get hit with super high deductibles and copays. That is where the AirMed Care Network steps in. When you join AirMed Care as a member, if an emergency arises requiring transportation by air, you will not see a bill when flown by an AMCN provider. And you can have that peace of mind for your entire household beginning at the low, low price of just $85 a year. AMCN providers transport more than 100,000 patients per year. As a listener to this very show, you can get, along with your new membership, a $50 Visa or Amazon gift card. So it's basically free the first year. This is the kind of coverage that no family should be without. Simply visit airmedcarenetwork.com/reason and use the offer code REASON. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. Okay. In the wee small hours Friday night, after months of negotiations, the House of Representatives passed by an 8-vote margin a $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill to match legislation that had already been passed previously in the Senate. President Joseph Robinette Biden Jr., who is expected to sign the thing into law today, we're taping this on Monday morning, described the bill, quote, as a once-in-a-generation investment that's going to create millions of jobs, modernize our infrastructure, our roads, our bridges, our broadband, a whole range of things, turn the climate crisis into an opportunity. The president further said the law will put the U.S. on a path to win the economic competition for the 21st century. Final direct quote from Joseph Robinette Biden Jr. This is a blue-collar blueprint to rebuild America. And it's long overdue. Catherine, I heard a lot of trigger words for you in that quote. Do you care to explain how your understanding of this bill slash law is different from that of the 46th president?
Yeah, I really don't appreciate that you just came out here Monday morning and just like went right for the jugular. We have the investment fallacy. We are investing. All this money is going to grow somehow into more money. It will definitely not be money that just disappears into a giant black hole of government nonsense. It's an investment. It's fine. It is not, for the most part, an investment. I know that people like infrastructure. There's a reason that every time Donald Trump kind of got bored or in trouble, he said it was infrastructure week. You know, people across the board think that it would be a good idea for the government to build roads and bridges and stuff. This bill contains some of that. But the U.S. government, I think, actually, in a way that makes me... This is one of the very few things that makes me pessimistic is how incredibly bad we are at building basic infrastructure at this point in our country. Both roads and bridges, also buildings, just like it takes so long to build a thing here. So I find the sort of build back better framing ironic always because we are quite bad at building things right now. In this country, we get in our own way in a pretty spectacular way. This bill does a lot of that. There are things in the bill that will make it harder and more expensive to do the other things in the bill. We are also not trying to win. As you well know, Matthew Lee Welsh, and you read me that quote anyway, we are not trying to win in this world. We are trying to cooperate. We are trying to make things, you know, better, more fair, more free, more fun. We don't really care what other countries are getting up to, but we wish them the best. And frankly, I guess it could have been worse, but also, holy be Jesus, is this a lot of money mostly for dubious and certainly not COVID-related ends, although I don't even know if we're pretending that anymore.
Suderman, the bill provides about $550 billion in new spending. including $110 billion for roads, bridges, and projects, $39 billion for public transit, and $66 billion for railways, plus another $65 billion for broadband infrastructure deployments, whatever that means, and $55 billion for clean water investments. What strikes you as particularly worthy of critique that Catherine hasn't mentioned so far?
Yeah, so this is an infrastructure bill that's supposed to get us more and better infrastructure, but will actually have the effect of making infrastructure more expensive. And so you've got a bunch of provisions in this bill that are going to make construction projects specifically more expensive to build. And so there's the Buy American provision, which is just totally needless. It's going to make things more expensive if it helps, if it does anything at all. You've got provisions requiring that most of the projects that this thing ends up funding will have to abide by Davis-Bacon rules, which are basically labor laws that drive up labor costs on construction projects by making employers pay prevailing wages, which are basically union wages. You've also got a bunch of expensive environmental reviews built into this thing. And of course, you've got money for port expansions, which, you know, seems like a great idea right now in some ways because all of our ports are clogged. But all this stuff has to abide by the Jones Act and other existing regulations that make our ports, you know, expensive to build and expand and to operate. And so this is this is an infrastructure bill that is, in a lot of ways, it's just a handout to unions and to union labor. And so when Joe Biden talks about this being, you know, building back better for the for blue collar workers and for and being great for labor, what he means is this is a bunch of handouts for his labor allies. And I would specifically point to the broadband provisions that you mentioned. So there's $65 billion for rural broadband access there. The vast majority of that money, about $43 billion or so, is going to go to state grants. And that provision is basically just a handout to telecom unions, because the way it's written, it's somewhat complicated and somewhat, you know, obscure. We don't need to go into all the details, but the way that that is written is that virtually all of that money is going to go to projects that employ labor workers in telecom unions. And so this is just, I mean, in some ways, it's a way of getting votes from rural legislators who like that sort of thing and who have been itching for this kind of money for a decade at least. But in other ways, this is just Joe Biden looking to hand out a lot of money to his union allies.
Nick, I would invite you to take a look at the kind of macro budgetary implications. The Congressional Budget Office has projected, and of course, they have to project based on their own criteria, which the legislation is written around to make it look better than it actually is. So lots of grains of salt. But this is going to add $256 billion, not to the debt, but to the deficit. The deficit is the thing that happens every year. The debt is the whole price tag for the stuff that we owe for later. A more accurate reading would be that it's going to add $400 billion to the deficit. Remind us why that's not good.
Yeah, well, first I want to say that I think Joe Biden should be giving unions a hand up, not a hand out.
Thank you.
So this thing is already misbegotten from
the
beginning.
Why not both?
But the more, well, how about this? You get nothing. I mean, this is a time to have a President Michael Corleone, where, and you know, this is the thing. Like, I was going to talk about the $66 billion that's going to passenger and freight rail. And what's interesting about that is the passenger rail is Amtrak. I'll get to that in a second. Freight rail is, the freight system in America is effectively privatized, and it's doing well because railroads know how to carry freight, and they do their own infrastructure, and they do their own stuff. This is a good example of where the government is spending money that it shouldn't, it doesn't have to do. You can expand that to things like ports. There are trillions of dollars in private investment around the globe that is dying to get in and update our port systems and things like that. They would be able to build them better and run them without costing taxpayers any money. And we can be doing that with bridges and with toll roads and with all sorts of stuff. So this is not a once in a lifetime, you know, piece of legislation. It's merely the latest dumb continuation of bad, stupid policies that a government that has $30 trillion in debt really can't afford to be taking out on. The other thing that, you know, and then to talk about Amtrak, you know, a big part of it is the only part of Amtrak that comes close to covering its costs when you exclude capital costs is the Northeast Corridor, you know, the Boston-Washington thing. Of course, what they're going to do in Amtrak is they're going to modernize and they're going to get rid of their maintenance backlog because it's poorly run and stupidly run. And they're going to extend and expand lines, you know, going from, like Ames, Iowa to El Paso, Texas, or other places that nobody is using because it doesn't make sense. There's also, you know, 10 or 15 billion in there for high speed rail because Joe Biden is a moron who is stuck in the past. And this was his great dream when he was 30 years old and 50 years old. And now when he's 80, he still gets to have his little choo-choo train dream. It's a waste and a total misdirection. On top of that, I think the other thing that's bugging me most about this is this bill has been framed in the mainstream media as saying like, oh, this is a good compromise because originally it was going to be twice as expensive. Plus, it was going to have the Build Back Better stuff, you know, which is another $3.5 trillion on it. And I saw, you know, people like Lloyd Blankfein and, you know, big CEOs talking about how, oh, this is a sign that, you know, normalcy is coming back to Washington. Because instead of spending $2 trillion or $2.4 trillion we don't have, we spend $1.2 trillion that we don't have on stuff we don't need. The government doesn't need to be funding. It's very frustrating. And then, Matt, just to talk about your point, the more the government borrows to create, you know, spending and infrastructure, it reduces long-term economic growth. It freezes out investors from actually taking the types of bold, innovative plays that they would be doing if they were betting on the future rather than worrying about when all of this stuff is crashing down. This is a great time for the government to shift gears. And instead of trying to do everything, it could be doing fewer things better and then bringing in the private sector to actually deal with stuff the private sector can do well. To Catherine's point, you know, if you bring in big international firms, they know how to build roads, they know how to build ports, they know how to do stuff. We should be doing that. This is such a grotesque blown opportunity of a piece with Biden's entire, kind of political legacy, and it's a damn shame.
Catherine, building on Nick's point about media framing of this, you are a consumer of a lot of media, more than the average person probably listening to this, because it's our job. Not your job listening necessarily. Do you recall encountering over the past few months that we've been talking about this, or even when Donald Trump would talk about this periodically, do you recall seeing in any news outlet not named Reason any analysis or look back at what happened the last time we passed a big infrastructure thing, which was part of the 2009 American Recovery and Reinvestment Act? It was supposed to be the biggest investments in infrastructure this nation has seen since Eisenhower created the interstate highway system. And that's like, it's as if it never happened. Have you actually seen any analysis anywhere else?
Astonishingly little. I'm not going to say zero, because every now and then you do get like a very sort of broccoli-ish piece of journalism that looks at that. But it's so beside the point. It's so beside the point. And, you would think, right, in a sane world, the way you would make the case for a bill like this is to say the last time we did a bill like this, it was really helpful. It did all these good things. Behold the good things that bill did. Instead, we get this weird kind of amnesia thing where it's like, well, no one's ever thought to do Infrastructure Week before. What an idea. Perhaps some spending on infrastructure is just the ticket. It's as if it's never happened. And there is no reference to past record of success or failure. And as we've talked about on this podcast, it's all of the coverage, 100% of the coverage was about two things. One, the politics of the bill. Will this be a win for Democrats? Who cares? Oh, my God. I could not care less. But it turns out basically everyone in America cares a lot because they are either on Team Red or Team Blue. So there's the politics of the bill. Also, of course, the internal politics of the bill for the Democrats. Dems in disarray, progressives running the caucus, blah, blah, blah. And then the other coverage was just entirely about the bottom line number. How big will that number be? The bigger the better, according to some, or just no, according to others, but not like the Republicans were just astonishingly absent in this conversation broadly. Like, I guess they were against it. They were all going to vote against it.
Well, the infrastructure bill, 19 Republicans in the Senate, but then did they end up going.
Right. So then they did.
Voting it did, for
and,
it a did
and 13 in the House.
A bipartisan bill. And in fact, some Dems voted, you know, decided not to participate. But the total lack of conversation that would happen in a normal world in which we asked the question, did this work last time? And, you know, not even across the board did this work last time, but like what parts worked? Maybe we should do just like those parts again and then try something new. No, none
of
that.
So I will slightly disagree with your assessment of the media coverage here, but it with a twist. I heard a lot of discussion about the 2009 stimulus bill, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, amongst liberal policy wonks. They talked about it a lot, and they said it didn't work because it wasn't big enough. And so what we need to do is make sure that we don't...
I take it back. I now like it if there is no conversation, because that's worse.
And this was their discussion, and this was a discussion that was happening amongst liberal policy wonks in the sort of journalism, think tank, and government world, where they looked back and they said, wow, we only spent a little bit less than $900 billion last time, and that didn't close the output gap. So what we need to do this time, when we have the opportunity in a recession and there's with COVID and jobs problems and all this, what we need to do is make sure we spend an awful lot more. And so they did that immediately in March with a $2 trillion bill. And then they wanted to move on to spending a whole bunch more after that, because they basically said it's just far, far better to overshoot, to spend more than you need to close the output gap than to spend less. We spent too little last time, so let's do the opposite this time. And even if we do end up spending a little bit too much, that'll be great, because we'll be spending it on stuff that will be great, that we'll have for generations, and we'll remake America into a better place.
Yeah, you know, part of here's an optimistic read on the terrible media discussion about this is that I think people, the boosters of this as a stimulus project, recognize that the American, you know, the ARRA was a failure. So, you know, then they're stuck with saying, oh, well, you know what, it was too small. That's why it didn't work. That's kind of good that they're acknowledging, you know, at least in the rearview mirror, that the stimulus package under Obama to get us out of the recession in 2009, 2010 didn't work. The other thing, though, is that in Biden's main push for this, it was more about stuff is falling apart and we need this stuff. It was not really done. I mean, there's some, you know, genuflection to the idea that this is going to build a lot of jobs and all of that kind of stuff, but it's more out of a sense of need. And, you know, I mean, this is looking for a pony in an enormous pile of manure, but it's that, you know, on a certain level, the Keynesian project of just saying the government can spend a lot of money and that's going to kickstart the economy or take it from point A to point B to point Z, that argument is kind of dead. And I think that's, you know, that's something that's worth thinking about. And it's something that's worth forcing people to admit when they say, you know, what government spending stimulates the economy. There's a voluminous economic research that the government multiplier, especially in it, borrows money, is less than one, so that for every dollar the government spends, you're getting less than a dollar back in economic activity. Let's run with that.
My favorite little anecdote from the 2009 stimulus bill came from a Mercatus study that came out just a couple of years after the bill, you know, after the money went out. In the study, the authors interviewed a contractor who had decades of experience building government buildings. And so that was his job. And he was in the works. He was in the process of planning a new government building somewhere out in the middle of the country. I forget exactly where, but he was planning to lay the tile that he always lays in one of their hallways. And then the spending bill passed, and the money got distributed, and the plans changed. And so instead of using the tile that he always used, which was this big, cheap, easy to lay tile, they told him, no, what you're actually going to do is use the tiny tiles. And they had him go in and redo the plans so that he would have much more elaborate, much more expensive tiles to lay down inside this government building. And that's the kind of thing that ARRA ended up funding in a lot of cases. That was the infrastructure spending that we got out of that was, no, instead of using efficient, cheap tiles, they used really expensive, difficult to lay, time-consuming small tiles because that's what they could spend it on. And the imperative was not to spend it on things that were worthwhile, but just to find things to spend it on, whatever it ended up being.
I just want to take any opportunity, whether it is appropriate or not, to remind everybody of the phrase recovery through retrofit. Just look it up. Mm. It's great.
Biden was a big fan of that. He was going to be Scotch guarding all the windows in America.
And also making sure that every last dollar was spent wisely and correctly of not just the stimulus, but the bailout money as well.
I think that was the motto for the production designer on Blade Runner.
I just remember a lot of stuff about weather stripping, which I'm sure I'm still not clear what weather stripping is. Like, I'm not a homeowner.
So sexy.
So I don't know. And I hope to never know.
A potential, or one of the, I should say, backdrops, political backdrops of this passage of the bill was last Tuesday's elections, which featured an upset victory in the Virginia governor's race when Republican Glenn Youngkin beat Democrat Terry McAuliffe. There was also a surprisingly narrow reelection. I'm not even sure if the Republican in this race has conceded in New Jersey, reelection for Democratic Governor Phil Murphy. There's all kinds of down ballot upset victories on Long Island. That's in New York. And some rando trucker.
It's really part of Germany.
Thank you for recognizing it. The trucker in New Jersey spent $153 or something and unseated one of the most longstanding polls. I don't know how to say that exactly, in the state. So there are a lot of competing interpretations over what was the significance, the message, the whatever, the factors that went into this, and also how it should be interpreted in the case of Biden's big domestic agenda. Basically, a lot of Democrats were like, well, this just proves we need to build back better, even faster. So starting with Catherine, what is a bit of significance that you take or just noteworthiness that you take out of Tuesday?
So I am generally not one to look at polls too closely because Stephanie Slade, my esteemed managing editor and colleague, has convinced me that I don't know what they are telling me. She's created a sense of like radical doubt about my ability to interpret polls that maybe is healthy for me, honestly. But I will.
So she's nagging you?
No, she's just emphasizing my own fallibility in a way that is completely fair. Mm.
Is that nagging? Kind of
is that might be what nagging is.
I think it is. Yeah.
Oh, much it's like a, weather
you know,
stripping.
She's looking out for you, Catherine.
Much like weather stripping, I hope to not encounter nagging in the wild or exactly understand what it is ever.
Let's get some polling data about weather stripping.
Yeah. But there, the tidbit from our friend Kristen Soltis Anderson's Echelon Insights that I thought was extremely valuable was in the Virginia race, Virginia went to Joe Biden by 10 points a year ago. Glenn Youngkin took K-12 parents by 15 percentage points. That's it. That's what you need to know about Virginia. Parents were really, really mad, just super mad, furious. And they voted accordingly. And I think this notion that somehow this state went from plus 10 Biden to plus 10 like virulent racists and transphobes is not a good theory. The much more plausible theory is that parents were mad that schools were closed for so long and that then when the schools reopened, they were told to sit down and shut up. And they were told that almost explicitly by Terry McAuliffe, by Glenn Youngkin's opponent, who said, I don't think parents should be telling schools what they should teach. And we talked about that on this podcast. But I think that sentence lost him the election. And I am delighted that if what Republicans take into the next cycle is, hey, school choice is good, I remain concerned that what Republicans will take instead is let's ban critical race theory.
Nick, what's your takeaway of significance from the election on Tuesday?
I think it's always great when favorites get upset. I like that in sports. I like it in politics. And I worry extremely about what Catherine is worrying about, which is that Republicans and specifically people like Youngkin are going to take this message. This is a guy who, when he was actually campaigning, his big plan to, he was in favor of school choice and he was going to like double the number of charter schools or something in Virginia to like 20 or 25 or something like that. He's not a school choice proponent by any stretch of the measure. He's not in favor of the...
Like, he really is.
Okay, he's not in favor of backpack funding. What? Where is his plan? He's not saying we're going to get rid of school districts. We're going to put parents in charge. He is... opportunistically using the critical race theory and the backlash against schools. Parents everywhere are pissed off because schools have been shut down. He is not a big school choice proponent. And the Republicans, you can already see this where people are saying, we need to fight a culture war now, and it's going to be built around CRT and about the, you know, the dark fears of trans bathrooms screwing up stuff. Having said that, you know, the big takeaway is this is a leading indicator. The Republicans are going to win gigantically in 2022 because of typical trends and a swing away. Biden is unpopular. His approval rate has sucked. The economy sucks. Everybody is unhappy. The president's party always loses, like on average, 37 seats in the House in the first midterm election. Look for it to be bigger under Biden. And what worries me, though, is the Republicans are going to wage culture war issues. You don't hear them talking about cutting government spending anywhere. So we're going to, you know, from a libertarian perspective, the biggest problem is that we're going to have this fierce culture war about stuff that ultimately does not matter and doesn't give individual parents, much less individual taxpayers, much less non-parents and citizens, more money in their pockets or more freedom to live however they want.
If you look at Youngkin's education page, he's the number two bullet point was ensure schools are never again closed unnecessarily for extended periods of time. Period. There's not a lot about trans bathrooms. He nearly tripled from 7 to 20 the number of charter schools, which is abysmally small. It's still an increase. And he didn't approve backpack funding, but he did approve provide $500 per public school student in refunds to parents to spend how they see fit to invest in student educational recovery, FWIW. Peter, what's one of your takeaways from Tuesday?
Yeah, I think there were two things that stuck out to me. One is that it doesn't work to make an election about Trump when Trump isn't on the ballot. I mean, Terry McAuliffe just tried to make this a referendum on Trump, and it simply didn't work because Trump wasn't there. And partly that's because Trump is off of Twitter and being and therefore sort of feels less present in this sort of thing, but also because he wasn't up for election. He's not in office. And so the election was actually about the issues that people cared about, which turned out to be education. But the second thing that I want to talk about here is the wrong lesson that Democrats have taken from this, which is that they have decided that this means they need to pass Build Back Better, which is the big social spending bill, the reconciliation bill, the nearly $2 trillion partisan bill with all the spending on healthcare and climate change and all of that stuff that they've been dickering over for months now. They have decided that what this means is they need to pass it now, faster. They just need to get it done with. And so there was a centrist Democratic activist group that put out a statement last week after the Virginia election. And what they said was, I'm only slightly paraphrasing here. This is nearly word for word. What they said was, voters mostly don't know what's in this bill. And what they do know about it, they largely don't like. And then this centrist group said, and so what we need to do is just get it, go ahead and pass this thing so we can start explaining the benefits to voters. And that is their logic right now, is that they seem to think that because they have the momentum against them and a very big, somewhat unpopular bill that people don't really understand, their job now is to pass that bill that people don't like and that will make people like them.
They'll learn to love it. They'll learn it. You have to pass it to find out what's in it. And having done so, you'll learn to love it. That, I think, is the current thesis.
Good luck with that, guys.
It's like an arranged marriage of bills.
We're going to get to our email of the week next. So keep sending those great questions to roundtable@reason.com. Put a little bug in your ear. We're going to be doing our annual webathon. Ask us video thingy majig coming here in a few weeks. That's going to be exciting. This email comes from Lady Dada. That's just a really outstanding pseudonym. I'm going to read part of it because, like too many of your emails, it's too long, but it's very thoughtful and great. And here's some bits. Over the course of the pandemic, I have listened to you all praise the use of masks despite the shaky evidence of their efficacy. I have listened to you extol the vaccine. While you always pause about rules from the government, you are all terribly blasé about rules from the culture. I'm an attorney. All of my colleagues and I are fully vaccinated, yet we wear masks in the office. I hate it. We are all required to be vaccinated. I hate it. Your response would be to find another job. I think Peter just had the audacity to suggest that switching employers is similar to going to a different restaurant because you don't like the spaghetti at the Olive Garden. Here's the main point. For me, libertarianism is more than just a paradigm for government. It's a life philosophy. I'm weary of the idea that anything goes, even if it's bad, as long as it only happens in the private sector. I'm writing this email using a ridiculous pseudonym.
Pseudonyms are inherently ridiculous.
Inherently pseudonymous, too, because I would not want my employer to know that I read and listen to reason. They could fire me if they associate me with anything that looks unwoke. This is okay with you? Sure, I could quit my job, but any other job will have the same requirements. This doesn't really represent choice. Out here in the real world, you do not get to choose your job so easily. I do not have the option of being a professional libertarian. Whew. So I jab and mask so I can keep making enough money to help my parents no matter what I believe or what I wish to do with my body. This is okay with you? All right, Suderman. She's calling you out.
Yeah, so I have a lot of sympathy for this person. This is a hard situation to be in. It sucks. It just sucks. And I know a lot of people, I am close with a lot of people who are in similar situations in big high-profile firms in particular, in tech, in media, in finance, people who are just terrified on a daily basis, an hourly basis even, of their colleagues and in particular of their HR departments and the way their HR departments appear to now just be enforcing a kind of firm-wide leftism and an expectation of paying lip service, often literally having to sign statements or say things in front of in front of people who are important in the firm, or make public statements of some kind. I mean, just crazy, crazy stuff that people are like, this has nothing to do with our work. It's wrong. I don't believe it. And I think it is. I think it's, first of all, undermining our organization. And it's also making my life incredibly difficult. And it's really, really hard. And so, I may have been a little too flip with my Olive Garden comparison before. I just want to say, like, I get it. And I know a lot of those folks. And that is a world that I am, that is not, the my own workplace, but that is a world that I am very, very close to in a lot of ways. But what I would say is also there is a sort of underlying thing here that you have to sort of always go back to, and that's that free association has to go both ways. And so in the same way that there are things you might want from an employer, but you also have to find an employer who wants those things from you. And this is how we negotiate these things, is that you have to find somebody who you can work for or who you can work with, who is going to have, whose expectations are going to be tolerable for you and whose requirements are going to be tolerable for you. And in the same way that if this person is ever going to hire someone, this person is going to have expectations for that person. Now, maybe, probably, our delightful Lady Dada, I think that's the name here, right? Lady Dada, soon anonymous, a lawyer here, will probably not say, okay, you know what, the person who's cut my yard or whatever, needs to have a certain political views. At the same time, we need to preserve the optionality for employers and employees to negotiate this sort of thing amongst themselves. And to me, a huge, one of the core tenets of libertarianism and of libertarian both as political philosophy and as cultural philosophy, as a sort of way of just looking at human interaction and the world, is that we can say, this sucks. This is a bad position to be in. And I don't like the way that society has gone here, right? Where lawyers feel like they can't admit to their colleagues that they read Reason magazine. That's crazy. That is not a good world to live in. And on the other hand, we need to say that the place that this sort of thing gets worked out is in the private sector between between individuals and organizations who are making decisions for themselves. And so that is a hard thing to do because it's hard to be a person and it's hard to work things out with other people. But
just the headline.
Yeah.
It's hard to be
hard to be a person. I think that's a
I have a huge amount of empathy here. But I also feel like there's not a top down solution, a way of coming in and imposing a, well, you know what? All law firms need to allow their lawyers to read Reason magazine publicly. Right.
I don't think the writer was saying that. And I think she is right to call into question the idea. Is libertarianism fundamentally only about the relationship of the individual to the state or to some kind of public power? I, for a very long time, have not subscribed to that. I think you need to be libertarian, you know, when you're in the public square and when you're in your private bedroom.
What about your public bedroom?
And I think... and this is the difference between thick and thin. I'm libertarian in the sheets and in the streets, Peter.
Oh, no.
I think you know that. I think you know
Please
that.
Don't
about
tell
it.
Us how he knows that.
But it's no.
Because
but
he
what
wears
we
his
need to
into the streets,
you know, what we need to be working towards, what we need to
Mattress
be working
boy.
Towards at Reason, and I think this is part of our mission, is to create a world in which office spaces, every bit as much as you know, political, you know, rules. People are just looser and more comfortable with pluralism and tolerance at every level. It's a fractal philosophy. You should be more libertarian at the subatomic level as well as at the, you know, the level of a society or of a civilization. And I think one of the ways you do that is by engaging in robust debate and, you know, sometimes low levels of persuasion. The piece that I wrote a couple months ago for the magazine about cancel culture, a taxonomy of cancel culture, that's one of its premises, is that this stuff, it works on different levels. It works on the individual and on the personal level, as well as the corporate level, as well as the government level. We need to be making people more libertarian, or to think about that as a general framework for all interaction. So I feel bad for the person, but I also think she's misrepresenting a lot of what actually Reason talks about and tries to push.
Actually, yes, I wanted to point out, I don't love masks. I hate masks. And they make me mad and infuriated. Catherine, is there a third way between Peter's pseudonym and Nick's fractal sheets?
I also am against indoor masking requirements at this point. I just don't think the mandates work at all.
I think that... both of my colleagues are correct, and also that although I love the vision of fractal sheet-based libertarianism, it is a wrong understanding of libertarianism to say only when everyone's heart looks like Nick Gillespie's have we achieved libertarian paradise. Only when everyone's heart is capacious enough for this pluralistic vision in which they are just super chill with people doing whatevs around them are we there, because I think that there is...
What a misrepresentation of what I said, but thank
you. I mean,
you
know, I imagine a world in which everyone's heart looks like Nick's, and it is both inspiring and terrifying. But, you know, also in that world, there will be spaces that exclude people. Like, you have to, like, free association includes exclusion. And I, you know, would hope that people would be... open and pluralistic, and that they would be moving in that direction always, as Nick inspiringly describes. But I also think that you, in a libertarian paradise, if such a thing were ever to exist, there would still be workplaces where you can't read Reason. That is a feature of a truly free society, would be enclaves in which people have chosen restrictive aesthetic or sexual or ideological or other mores. And as long as you can enter and exit from those communities freely, then that is consistent with libertarianism. I know that that's a thing that us cosmopolitan elites don't like to think about as much, but I do think it's an important piece. I also feel super bummed for Lady Dada and her secret reading and her masked face. But I think that we have to make space for those clusters if we want space made for our cluster.
Yeah. Thank you for that good question.
I agree with that. But can I just say, like, you know, if we're talking about a law firm that just does general litigation or something like that, you know, it's one thing. And then being like, hey, you know, you go to the bathroom, you're a man and you stand up while you pee, you're out of here, you know, or you're politicizing bizarre, you know, ideas or profiles that have nothing to do with the business at hand. Again, private companies can do what they want, but they're idiots and they should be called out for that. That's like ridiculous. And we see in a world now where at universities, intellectual homogeneity and orthodoxy is being implemented at a very place that is supposed to stand for heterodoxy. You know, and again, you know, we're never going to get to the, you know, the event horizon of this stuff, but we can move in the right direction, which is that, like, if you own a gas station, I don't know, maybe the people, and I'm from New Jersey, it's showing because I'm about to say the people who are paid to pump gas, maybe they all don't have to be democratic socialists.
Oh, I think one,
you know, and maybe some of them might even be against the laws mandating that you have to have some idiot pump your gas for you, which is my first job out of college. So I thank Sunoco for starting me on this wonderful career that has led me to this dead end of a conversation.
When I was in high school, I used to do a lot of really awful, Weird Al style parodies of popular songs, Nick, as you could probably imagine. And
I hear them in my head whenever I shut my eyes.
And obviously, I wrote an entire one about a gas jockey just like you called Might As Well Pump. I did that, Nick, for you. I would just point out one thing to Lady Dada's points and to Peter's in between it, is that a lot of these changes, especially obviously having to do with COVID, because that's new, this stuff predates your employment. Like, suddenly your workplace is demanding that you give certain statements or doing X, Y, and Z having to do with coronavirus, and the velocity of that change can be super disheartening and dislocating for a lot of people. And the extent of which there's a government culprit lurking behind it at OSHA or anywhere else makes it all the worse. And I think that we should understand that those types of actions as generators of cultural conflict and just personal conflict. It's part of the reason why we're all a little bit less happy than we used to be, is that people are all up in each other's business, including in the workplace. Okay, one of the backdrops to this, and we don't have a lot of time to talk about it, but I want to because it's there, and I just mentioned OSHA. We've had a bunch of developments just over the past 5 days or so having to do with workplace mandates. OSHA came out with its promulgated regulations requiring vaccines or thereabouts at businesses of 100 employers or more. It was almost immediately challenged in the court, stayed by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. Now they're waiting to hear about the constitutionality and its fidelity to the statute and all that business. Meanwhile, last week, in addition to the sounds of Nick Gillespie snorting, we had 5 to 11-year-olds were now eligible for the vaccine. There's word on Friday, I believe it was, that we have pretty near miraculous therapeutic available for people, or that it's been proven through trials. I don't know when it's available precisely, but that reduces the injurious effects of COVID really, really sharply all at once. So all this great news is happening in terms of us being able to deal from the pandemic to the endemic. And then you got Rochelle Walensky out there saying, hey, you should just keep your mask on in our Ask the Science spot, Ask the Expert spot on Friday. Keep your mask on because, you know, cold and flu season. It's probably just a good idea to do that. So things are going in a lot of different directions. Eric Adams, the mayor-elect of New York, said that he wants to get rid of masks in schools, which is very happy. I get the feeling, Catherine, that there's just a subset of people in the public, in the media more, in the government perhaps even more than that, who can't let this stuff go. We got all this good news. Why can't we start letting this stuff go?
Yeah, I think that this actually is related to where we started in this podcast, which is we are not great at looking back at something that the government did, evaluating it, and then moving forward. This is a thing that we are not great at as a country. And maybe, like, this is just a thing that humans aren't great at. But this is how we have the take off your shoes at the TSA situation. This is how we have tons of states of emergency that are still in place from decades ago, legacy regulations about industries that don't exist anymore. And I think this is an important thing for Reason Magazine and for maybe libertarians writ large to focus on doing, which is that right now, there is still some space to roll a bunch of this garbage back. Like this, these laws are still soft. They are not set in stone. There are many, many forces in place that would like to keep the rules here forever because either of an excessive kind of interpretation of just, you know, if it saves one life, if it's, you know, just the sort of precautionary principle style approach, or because they don't want to admit that they were wrong, right? Like it was a dumb rule to begin with sometimes, and they just didn't get it right, and they don't want to admit that they were wrong. I think that this is something we can do to be helpful, is like keep pushing on these things that are temporary now but are about to become permanent, like masks on public transit forever and ever, like, you know, like all the other COVID restrictions that went into place. There's still time to roll that stuff back. And this is a job for libertarians. Like if there's I don't know what the bat signal would be, but like I am putting it up right now. It's an anarchy A in the sky. Like flock to it, my friends.
Nick, over the weekend.
Yeah, I was hoping that I think my contribution to this is to rename OSHA Oh Shit. And I think we're halfway home.
Just know.
I'm just going to redirect to Suderman after that.
You said your piece.
You don't want to add on to the brilliance. No, it's just like you don't belabor a beautifully put point. Suderman, over the weekend, Surgeon General Vivek Murthy, who I'm just going to insert this. I don't like him. I don't like him at all. When he talks? No.
Thanks for that, Matt.
He suggested on the weekend chat shows.
That's a great setup,
It's important
Peter.
That people know that nothing is...
You're now implicated in Matt's white supremacy?
Nothing... I don't see color. Nothing is off the table.
That's why you're a white supremacist.
When it comes to vaccine mandates on small businesses as well. Nothing's off the table. We should take that off the table, shouldn't we?
Yes. That's correct.
Clear the table.
No, yeah, I'm against.
Wipe it down. Walk away.
You don't like Vivek Murthy. I don't like tables, and in political discussions in particular, I just think we should get rid of them. Nothing. It's not just that nothing should be on the table. It's that there should be no table. Look, in the spirit of Catherine's point about looking back about and talking about what you got wrong, I should say, you know, I was probably the foremost proponent of masking on this podcast from March 2020 through March 2021 or so. And I will still defend masking as a concept, because obviously in certain settings, using high quality masks are useful. That's why we expect surgeons to wear them. But most people aren't surgeons, and most people aren't wearing surgical masks of high quality, having teams of specially trained people putting them on. And so when you look at any of the reviews of the evidence for mask mandates, again, separate from masking itself, but mask mandates, requirements by cities or states, you just can't find very much convincing evidence that they actually reduce transmission or stop people from dying or being put in the hospital. And so we should just not be having mask mandates at all anywhere in the country, because it's not obvious. It's just not at all obvious that they work. And yet we continue to have these things in schools in Washington, D.C., where we have an absolutely idiotic mask mandate that makes it incredibly inconvenient to do things like go into a small store or go to the gym, and yet allows people to go to very large concerts and restaurants and bars and basically not really wear masks at all, except on entry and exit. It's just insane. And the fact that we're sticking by with a lot of these policies is proof of Catherine's point that nobody actually looks at whether they work or not.
I mean, masks turned out to be the take off your shoes of COVID, not the like metal detector of COVID.
There was also
right?
a clearer case for masks, I think, or a better case for masks in a world where vaccines were not widely available. Because again, some amount of, masking in and of itself, high quality masking offers some level of protection that not masking at all does not offer. And so when that's the only thing that's available to you, say in November of 2020, there is some case for it. But once it makes sense kind of intuitively, just knowing what we know about how masks work. But mask mandates don't. And this is really something that you just can't find a systematic review of the evidence that shows a really strong, obvious effect over, multiple policies.
I think also our brains are so broken, or at least some people's brains are so broken by all this stuff that they equate, and by they, I do mean the parents at one of my kids' schools, they equate.
We know that's lifting. Who you always mean these days when you just talk about the ambiguous they.
That if we remove the mask mandates, that is removing masks. I mean, effectively, it's probably going to be, so there's some truth to it. But also, you can mask up as much as you want. You can mask your kids as much as you think that they're going to keep it on once you leave. However, you don't have to always have the government dictate what those of us who don't want masks on our kids do as well.
But that's what they want.
Get over it.
The point of the mask mandate isn't to mask their own kids. It's to mask yours, Matt.
Yeah. I mean, also...
Yeah, well, go...
This is,
in their eyes, I should say, the point is.
And in D.C., this is currently manifesting, in small employers, in small schools. Like, I just made my kids vaccine appointments. My kids attend a very small school. At some point, every kid in my kids' classes will be vaccinated, and D.C. law will still say, keep your mask on. At some point, everyone in our workplace was vaccinated, and the law still says, keep your mask on. And that puts everyone in a bad position where they have to decide how compliant they are going to be with a dumb law. And that is perhaps another question for another day.
I mean, it's also just decimated foot traffic downtown because a lot of the office reopenings that were planned for September and October simply didn't happen, in part because some people were concerned about Delta, but also because a lot of those employers looked at the mask mandate being put back in place and said, why would we bring people back into the office just to have them sit far away from each other, trying to communicate through masks? It's crazy. It's not going to work. And so what it has done is depressed commerce in our downtown corridor in a way that is really, it's really depressing. And it has kept DC from fully reopening in a lot of ways and I don't think it's had any meaningful effect on transmission or hospitalization and deaths.
Speaking of depressing commerce, let's go to what we've all been consuming culturally since the last time we convened on this roundtable. Nick, what have you consumed recently?
I have read, and now I just lost it. Where is it? It's Apollo's Arrow, the book that came out a year ago by Nicholas Christakis, a public health sociologist. The subtitle is The Profound and Enduring Impact of Coronavirus on the Way We Live. There's a new paperback edition that just came out, and I'm going to be talking to him about that and his findings in for this week's Reason interview podcast. Christakis is very much of a, I would say, like a fairly conventional mainstream and authoritative arbiter of what kinds of public health policies we should have been following. And he's highly critical of people like Andrew Cuomo and Bill de Blasio for taking too long to get rolling with what he considered meaningful effective interventions into stemming the coronavirus. But he's also, in the paperback edition especially, he's talking about, okay, how do we end? How do pandemics end? It's whether or not you agree with his particulars on COVID, it's an incredibly well-written, densely researched, and historically rich look at pandemics going back to antiquity through the current moment. So Apollo's Arrow.
Very good. Mr. Suderman, what Marvel Cinematic Universe product did you consume?
I watched Eternals, which is the latest in Marvel movie. It's the latest film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And it's bad. It's really quite bad. Possibly the worst film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And I have seen all of them. I've seen most of them. Actually, I'm pretty sure I've seen all of them except for Shang-Chi at least twice and maybe many more times than that. And so it's not just that it's bad. It's that it's really disappointing and a big missed opportunity. This movie was directed by Chloe Zhao, who directed last year's Oscar-winning Nomadland, which I really, really loved. And she tries to kind of translate some of her style, which is a very sort of focused on the natural world and on people in big, open, desolate spaces. And she tries to translate this into a Marvel movie, and it just doesn't work. This movie also draws from a lot of Jack Kirby's cosmic work, and you have these giant celestial characters, these planet-sized sort of god robot things, you know, that are, like, create stars and existence in the universe. And this imagery should be just incredible, and it's really kind of not. It's underwhelming, and it's particularly underwhelming coming so soon after Dune, which was a great movie about stuff that was just big and epic and felt enormous on screen in a way that I don't think I had ever seen before. And it really just kind of shows the limits of what Marvel can do with some of this stuff and of their strategy of hiring indie director darlings to make their big corporate products that are very formulaic and don't really let those people do what they do well.
That late Kirby stuff, which I would argue is by the time he went from Marvel to DC in the late 60s and early 70s, I mean, you got to be kind of honest if you're a comic book fan. It all is garbage for the most part. And like the Eternals was always going to suck if it was at all related to what Kirby originally put
on the
page.
Well, so I think that some of that material is goofy, and it is hard to translate because the characters don't really seem all that relatable or human, which is a problem for this film. But the imagery is really incredible. Just Google Jack Kirby Celestials, and you will see these splash panels that are just like bonkers. Wow. Comic book art of the best kind. It's pretty telling, I think, that DC canceled a New Gods movie, and New Gods is pretty much the DC version of the Eternals, and DC looked at that and tried to make that into a movie, developed it for a while, and then we're like, nope, this isn't going to work. Marvel, on the other hand, looked at that same material on their side of the comic book aisle and said, hey, let's try it, and nope, it didn't work.
Catherine, what have you been consuming?
I just want to know, Peter's reference to Dune there reminded me of a summary of Dune I saw this weekend that just said, so it's like a mother and son mumbling about space politics interspersed with perfume ads from Zendaya. And it was a criticism, but I was like, no, that's what I want from a movie. That's like a positive review. So I actually, you know, sometimes on this podcast, I'm like, I didn't really consume anything. And that's a little bit where I am today. But, you know, I think we give short shrift on these segments to the thing we produce, which is magazines. Like, we never talk about that. And I read the latest issue of Harper's, which attracted my eye because it's about space. The cover story is The Coming Battle Over Space. And it is by Rachel Reiterer, whose work I was not previously familiar with. But it's about space war. It's not about the private space sector. Elon Musk does not appear in this piece until, you know, several thousand words in. So that tells you the kind of piece this is. And I thought that it's not the most interesting thing about what's happening in space, but I was glad that someone gave me a good summary of what's going on in terms of the defense applications of space that wasn't just lol Space Force. And just in general, Harper's Magazine, kind of good, y'all. Like, I know the Harper's letter is the most defining thing that Harper's has done in recent memory, and Harper's didn't really do it, but I recommend the November issue of Harper's if you happen to be, as I am, interested in space, but are maybe a little weak on the not woohoo rockets side of the equation.
There was a great Dan Baum feature in Harper's a couple of years ago. He's like a liberal, and he's a, you know, like a magazine journalist liberal who was like, guns, what are those? And then he got a concealed carry license, and it was a really like kind of honest and open piece about like how it changed his perception of what it meant to be a gun owner and somebody who carries guns.
So
He also wrote their fantastic piece, Legalize Them All, about legalizing all drugs. He died in the past couple of years, but he's very good. And a Harper's property.
So last night I went to, I think, the first concert that I have gone to since the coronavirus, since the novel coronavirus, as we used to call it. It
Not
was
the short and story it was just coronavirus.
It was a novel, unfortunately. It turned out to be like a Tolstoy levels of coronavirus.
A loose and baggy monster.
So it was a concert at St. Anne's Church in Brooklyn Heights. It's big old church there I'd never walked into before, even though it's down the street. And it was the last surviving member of the band Big Star, the failed mid-70s power pop band who's put forth a bunch of remarkable music and just like absolutely imploded. Alex Chilton is the most famous member of that band. Chris Bell is the other one who wrote a lot of songs, sang a lot of songs. They're all basically dead. And there's one guy left, a named Jody Stevens. And they've been putting on, I came to find out after I saw the concert, they've been putting on these kind of, Big Star third act of people who just love the band and who are in a bunch of different other bands. So Mike Mills from REM was there. There was a couple of dudes from the Posies, Peter Holsapple. Band of about 10 people came on there, and it was such a gorgeous and moving set of songs that mean a lot to me, but it was so great to see them in a church setting, and so great to see live music. It was just a absolutely beautiful thing. There's apparently a concert documentary thing that came out about 4 years ago having to do with that. Short of that, look around and see if they're coming to a town near you. It doesn't seem like it. This is basically their first show in a few years as well. And if nothing else, always just, ask your robot to shuffle songs by Big Star. If you're not familiar with them, you will recognize a few, much to your surprise. But just a wonderful experience, and I can't recommend highly enough to go see live music. But also to see live music in a church when it's Big Star with a bunch of really great musicians. That's all the sermonizing I have time for. We have time for the Reason Roundtable podcast. Look at our stuff at reason.com/podcasts, including the interview with Nick Gillespie in the Soho Forum debate series. And we will catch you next Monday. Goodbye.